and welcome to another episode of the Tabletop Inquisition podcast with your hosts, Oliver, and we've got the lovely...
Well, I'm Tanash. I like that you keep calling me lovely. I don't know how I'm going to get used to this.
It's the second time now.
It's just so much praise. All in one word. Okay. Hi, I'm Antoinette, and of course we're hanging out with Oliver here, and we have a really, really special episode today because we have a wonderful guest with us. Are you as excited as I am, Oliver?
Yes.
I'm so excited.
I'm very excited. We've got this guest. Well, I think there's quite a few things we want to talk about. And let me introduce her. She is a designer of, I think two games are basically, one's published, one's just about to come out, or is already, I think it's actually also in people's hands. A third one, I think, is lined up. She's also the creator of the Board Game Survival Toolkit. She also publishes the Indie Tabletop newsletter. I'm talking about Nikita Sullivan from Attican Games. Hello, Nikita. How are you?
Hello, I'm good, thank you.
Welcome to the podcast, and I hope you're ready for our fun questions, which I think we'll probably start with before we look at, you know, all the work you've been doing in design and Kickstartering and fulfilling and all those things. Exactly, the interesting things. But I guess we'll just ease ourselves in with some sort of fun questions first, if you're ready.
Yep, I'm ready.
Okay. Antoinette, do you want to ask the first one?
Absolutely, because this is one of my favorite and possibly the most important questions on the list. And so we're going to start off with, what color crayon are you?
So I would be a green crayon. Because green has been my favourite colour for quite a while. That's why. I'm really bad at favourites, but colour I can manage.
Okay.
The next question is it for you a walk on the beach or in the hills or somewhere else if you really don't like either of those?
Definitely the hills.
The hills, yeah. Yes.
I like the idea of hiking a lot more than getting sand in my shoes. I do love the beach, but between the two, I'd go for hills.
Hills, yeah. Do you live somewhere sort of hilly then?
Yeah, not really. Well,
this is the best answer ever.
I really love the idea of like going on a walking holiday in the Lake District or something like that. I think it would be fantastic.
Yeah, okay.
That sounds pretty great.
I like walking as well.
Well, the hills and that green colour crayon go together very appropriately.
Yes.
You know, maybe I just love green.
Maybe you just do. That's not a bad thing. That would be a pretty good thing. I'm now going to jump onto something completely different, which is, if you had to have something to eat right now, what would it be?
Oh, that's an easy one. I've been craving chocolate all day.
Any particular type of chocolate that you favour over others?
I do really love Bourneville.
Oh, wow.
Oh, okay.
You're a special individual.
Am I? I don't get to have that very often.
You'd be great to have round for rose for the tin of roses. Do you ever have those at Christmas? And then the last chocolate in the bottom is always the Bourneville.
Oh,
is that just me?
Do you mean the coconut ones are normally the last ones?
In your house, okay.
Oh, I see. Different ones, different ones.
People's, it's coconut. I really like coconut, but I don't think there's a Bourneville one in roses. Like Bourneville is just a brand of dark chocolate. That's all it is.
I thought there was a miniature one. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm right. I don't know. I think there used to be one, but I've never seen a big bar of it. I've only ever seen the little mini ones. So that's where I have the idea.
I buy big bars and they don't last very long.
That is the nature of chocolate. Yeah. Awesome. And you like the dark chocolate.
Well, I don't know how I can follow this with the chocolate, but if budget was no question, you had as much money and could live anywhere and whatever, what would your dream house look like? Where would it be? What would be in it and all those sort of things?
So genuinely, it would probably be in the New Forest.
Okay.
And it would probably be as close to my house as possible, but detached instead of semi-detached.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I like the idea that we don't have sharing walls with people. And a massive extension that would be my board game warehouse.
Ooh. All right.
But I live quite close to the New Forest, and we got married in the New Forest, so I have a lot of love for it.
Right. Okay. I was wondering whether there was a link. Gotcha. Nice.
That's lovely.
Nice place to get married.
I love that everyone else dreams of having a game room and you go all out with a warehouse. I never thought that big before. I'm I should have thought bigger. like, you know, in your imagination.
Right, so I only have 2 games published, and so far I have 8 boxes of games in my office.
Oh, I so. See. Okay.
They're in the game. Yes. Yeah.
That's the dream.
That's the dream. I like it. Okay, this is a little bit more grounded than some of the others. So kind of what got you into board games in the first place? Have you always played them?
So I've always played, like, family, we played like Monopoly or card games. We played a lot of card games. And then like things like Game of Life and Backwards and stuff like that. People ask a lot, like, how did you get into board gaming? And I just feel like it's always been there. But then obviously, as I grew up and had gaming friends as well, I'd get to know more and more games. So it just kind of escalates to the point where you're like, well, I've played that with you and really enjoyed it. I'm going to have to buy it and play it with other people now.
yeah. Exactly. Collection grows and grows.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think I know the answer to this, but what's your favourite colour, Meeple?
Green.
Green, yes. Yay, that was green. Easy.
I agree. It's always green, isn't it?
Yeah.
So if you have a new player around to play board games with you, what game would you show them first?
So because I'm me, I would show them Try to Win. But in general, I think those kind of quick to learn little card games that do have a bit of strategy to them, like Try to Win, Flux, Love Letter, stuff like that, are really good to get new people to go like, all right, I really enjoyed that. What else is there?
Yeah, I was going to say that those sort of little games, it's getting them started. Yep. And getting them hooked, I suppose. And then just finding out what they're like and then going from there. Good idea, definitely. Now, this is probably actually more of a serious question than a fun question, but if you have a dominant player in your games group, you know, the alpha player, quarterback, or whatever you want to call it, how would you deal with such a player if there was someone in your games group like that?
So I do know people like that. So I do have I do have examples to draw upon.
okay. So, no names, please.
No, definitely not. I'll never be invited back.
okay, that's a clue there.
I think the best thing that I've done in that situation is just making, because I think a lot of people who are a bit more shy than that are then kind of forced out of the game. Especially if it's like a co-op game and that one person is just making the decisions for everyone. So I tend to just try and make it so that everyone's chatting. So I'll ask questions of the people that are being quiet.
Right, okay.
But another way to deal with them is just to ignore them and get through it. Because at that point, you're not enjoying your game. Like, if they've reached the point of dominance where you're thinking of them in that light,
yeah,
they're probably not helping your gaming experience as like a thing.
It's time for a different game at that point, or maybe a different friend.
I've been to lots of board gaming groups where you're like playing with strangers, and because they're a stranger, I just do that thing of like asking other people, oh, are you okay with that? What do you think we should do? Like, it feels like it's a thing that's for like co-op games or like the social deduction games.
Yeah.
That's when I've seen the dominant players come out and they just want everyone to use their strategy, or they're very big advocates of, no, it's not me. It's clearly that person over there because I've done this, that and the other. And you're like,
right, yeah.
Say it in a nicer way though, hey? Yeah.
Excellent. Okay, so next up is, do you have a preference when it comes to weight of game?
So in general, no. Sometimes it depends on how I'm feeling and my mood. Like sometimes I just don't feel like getting a big heavy board game out and I'd rather just play a little game. But I do really like quite heavy strategy, heavy games and stuff. Yeah. But I don't play games like that very often because my husband doesn't like those kind of games and it's just us. So
yeah. Okay. I love it that it's the other way around in your house, because people always seem to assume that the ladies don't enjoy the heavier game.
Yeah.
So I love it's the fact that it's like it's the opposite or way around.
Yeah, so I bought am I allowed to just tangent off on a story?
Yeah, no.
Okay, I went to one of the board game groups where they had a bring and buy, and they had Ogre there. So I was like, oh, I have a go at that then, that will get that. And this guy just looked at me and went, you won't like that. Oh. oh, why not? I was just horribly polite to him. I was just like, oh, why not? And he was like, oh, it's like Warhammer, it's like this. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's cool. We've got Gaslands. I'm really looking forward to getting some cars and like making them look like rat rods. And then we'll play Gaslands and we'll do this. And he's just like, oh, okay, you might like it. And yeah, I just kind of go for a kind of kill them kindness thing there. And another guy was there who was really sweet, and he was, and I was like talking about how my brother used to play Warhammer, and I used to like seeing that he'd paint his minis up and stuff like that. And this other guy just like steered me away from him and went, oh, you don't want to talk to him about painting minis, you'll be here all day, come over here. And I was like, yeah. So he just like kind of rescued me.
Yeah, that's both funny and tragic at the same time, because women get such an unusual reception when it comes to, you know, a gaming events and stuff like that, especially with people you don't know. So I'm glad it ended nicely. Was Ogre any good in the end?
We still haven't played it.
You still haven't played?
No, we've got, they're on my shelf of opportunity.
Okay, that's fair, that's fair.
I think it's because things kind of fell through, like, towards the first lockdown happening, we were like, oh, we're going to go to charity shops, find like loads of little toy cars and paint them up cool and make them look like rat rods and do kind of a like Mad Max thing. And then all of anything like that, any kind of big thing that we wanted more than two of us to be playing, have kind of drifted off to the side while we just think about games that we want to play just us two.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I won't send you home with any homework then to play it.
It will happen, but it'll probably happen when so like our best friend that we've seen like once this year used to come around like every Wednesday night for board game night, so it would probably be something that once he can come around again, we'll do something like that.
That's good. It's something to look forward to.
Right, well, we've got one more fun question, and that is, what is your spirit animal? And can I guess? I don't know.
Green!
Green! Well, I would just go by your pet, which is a cat, but I don't know whether that would be a spirit animal.
I don't know if I really understand the spirit animal question.
No, okay.
Because I don't know if it's implying some kind of mysticism behind it.
No. It's just a fun,
I would probably go with cat or like a kind of feline energy in general. My life, I don't know what my life would be like without Captain, and he is my mascot as well, so
I was gonna say he's on the logo, so definitely no, we go with cat. As I say, there's nothing sort of you know mystical behind it necessarily, but sometimes you know it's quite nice to know roughly what animal you might
align yourself
might be
with
spirit animal. So yes. I like a cat. Yeah, exactly.
I typically love pets and animals in general, like we have this weird thing where cats are kind of just attracted to me, which is weird.
It's a great, so like, cool skill.
Like, we have a picture of me being a cat lady in Turkey on holiday where all of the cats, I was like sat on a sun lounger and three different cats decided one was going to sit by my feet, one was going to be at the back of it, and one of them was going to be at the side. And they were like nowhere near any other humans the entire time we were there.
Yeah.
And every time we've been to like B&Bs and stuff, and I'll get like a cuddle with a cat that lives there, and then the owner will come in and say, oh, don't bother with her, she hates people. And like, oh, all right, I won't tell you that I just had like a really nice purry cuddle with your cat.
Oh, brilliant. So definitely cat is your spirit animal in that case, I think. We've defined that.
Yeah, we've declared it so.
Well, I think that rounds up our fun questions quite nicely, which means we are moving on to our next session, which is our serious questions. Yeah. Well, they're not that serious, so.
No, not
really.
We'll
see you on the other side.
Okay, so welcome to the second section of our wonderful interview, where we're going to be asking what we're titling the serious questions. Is there a reason we call them serious? I don't know. They really just kind of get to know you.
Yeah, but I think they just sort of stand out against the fun questions. So fun and serious, I don't know. I don't know.
Fun and serious, yeah. We don't have an in-between, apparently.
No.
So anyway, we're going to start out with, which is was something I would genuinely like to know, which is like, when and why did you decide to start designing board games in the first place? Because it's a big jump to go from I like games, I play games, to I can make one. So I'd love to know how it all came about.
Okay, so obviously Try to Win was my first game, and my husband does triathlons. And we had this wonderful weekend where on the Saturday my husband did a triathlon at Blenheim Palace. And then I had, prior to this, convinced him and our best friend that since we'd be halfway to Birmingham anyway, we might as well go to UKGE for the Sunday.
As you do.
Yeah. So I think it's the combination of watching hundreds of people do a triathlon the day before and then going to UKGE, I got the idea for like Try to Win in my head.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like 90% there. I told my husband and my friend Matt about the idea and they were like, oh, it's brilliant. You should make it. But they're incredibly biased. One of them is married to me. So there's a lot of bias there. So I wish I'd had more belief in myself then, because I might have been on like my fourth or fifth game by now.
Yeah.
But it was like the following Christmas, I was like, well, I'm going to make that game for my husband's Christmas present. And I thought I was being all sneaky, because I was like, right, it was literally just pieces of paper. And I was like, oh, just try out this thing I want to try out, Darren. Mm. And my plan was to like playtest it with him, get it to make sure it's a game he wants, then I'll do all the graphics, get them printed, and it'll be a nice Christmas present.
Yeah.
And after our second game or something, he was like, so why don't you just do this for a living?
There you go.
And well, he really loves it. Every time I make a new game now, I say, what's your favourite game? And he still says, Try to Win, you made it about me. It's my game.
Yeah, aww, yeah. So cute.
And which I'd be perfectly happy for him to be like, oh no, definitely Malum Hortus, because that's got a lot more to it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so like, he kind of just was like, well, you could definitely do this. And at the time I was working as a freelance graphic designer anyway, so it wasn't like a massive jump to be like, well, I'll do the graphic design for myself and incorporate into my games and stuff.
Yeah.
And literally it was like the February after that it funded. See, and what happened really is that, he convinced me that I should make Try to Win a reality. And then as soon as I was playtesting with other people, I got this immense sense of joy seeing other people play my game without me playing, just me in the background and them playing, and them enjoying it. Mm-hmm. And there was a point where I was playtesting in a pub with a load of people that I'd never met before. They were just a local board gaming group, and I asked them. And like six people sat around a table playing Try to Win. And at the end, no question between everyone, they just instantly grabbed up the card, shuffled them, played again.
Wow.
It was exactly how like my family used to play like Rummy or something like that, where you don't even ask if we're going to play again, you just go. That kind of sense of joy I've never had with anything I've done before. So from that moment, I was just like, I'm making board games forever, for as long as I am able to.
So basically what started as a little present for your husband turned into a sort of playtest experience that you really enjoyed, and you basically didn't want to stop after that. Is that really sort of the summary?
Yeah, that's a good summary of it.
So thinking about that, Try to Win as your first, well, published game, I mean, I'm sure you had dozens of ideas before and after, maybe, I don't know. How easy was it actually to try and create a triathlon game? I mean, I can see obviously the game, how it works and all that, but to me, if I was asked, okay, now make a sports game, you know, as a board game, I wouldn't even know where to start. So, I mean, how did you go about making that idea a reality?
So the first thought I had for Try to Win was that it was definitely going to be people were building up their swimming, running and cycling skills, and that was secret and only you knew, and that everyone playing would also be making the swimming, cycling and running course.
Right.
So like those two things were like, that was always going to be happening. And then as I playtested, I added in more like action cards and things like that. So there's things like, yeah, I feel like everything has a thematic reason for it. So like if you steal a skill from another player with an action card, it's because they tripped over or they left their sports bag open or something like that. They failed to do a thing, so you've got their skill. If there's stop that cards, if someone's played an action, you can stop it. And they're all things like you've got lightning reflexes or cat-like reactions and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was all still coming back to it. And you could like remove a course card as well. And all of them are about bribing or confusing charming the race marshal.
Yeah.
So like I felt like there was a good reason behind each action.
Definitely very thematic. I mean, the whole game is. It's just, to me, sort of baffling to go right from my like a triathlon, you know, I can see it happening as a computer game, you know, where you press buttons and then you wriggle your joystick, you know, like all the sort of 1980s, 1990s games. But like as a board game, I was like, okay, how do you do it? You know, do you roll dice? What do you do? And, you know, I just found it fascinating how you created what's basically a card game out of this sort of idea. So just very fascinating to see that.
Because you kind of propelled yourself into the board game industry, right, fairly quickly. I was wondering, how do you find, you know, being part of kind of the bigger community, I suppose, as a whole? Like, how do you find working in the board game industry?
So, in terms of the community, I am so in love. Like, it's properly backed up the idea that I want to be part of it. Because I want to get my ideas out there, right? And I looked at BoardGameGeek.com and that seemed like a lot of people who were talking about Kickstarters were also talking about that.
Yeah.
So I very politely messaged on there and said, I haven't been part of the online board gaming community at all because I've always had friends that I play board games with. And I think if you have that, you don't necessarily have the reason to go online and find other players there or find your digital games. Like my friends, all of us have at least one shelf at home full of board games. So I literally just kind of explained that and said, but I've got this game and I, you know, would it be rude of me to like come in now and say, oh, I've never been part of this community, but please buy my game. And like everyone who responded to me was so nice. And they basically said, the fact that you're asking makes you better than like 90% of the people who try and get Kickstarters on here. And I was like, okay. All right,
yeah.
So I'm doing the right thing then. But no, I found it amazingly. I don't know if I've experienced much of the board game industry, as it were. I've got my games in one or two shops near me. Okay.
Yeah,
I don't work with distributors because I'm not sure I want to. I've spoken to a couple of like publishers and distributors when they've got in contact with me, and I'm quite happy selling my games just as me.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know if I have much or any real industry experience, as it were, but I try to do what I can within the indie board gaming community.
Yeah.
As well. So I quite like connecting with other new board game designers. It's really nice.
I was going to say, I mean, have you, you know, you said you don't work in the industry as such, but surely you have obviously met other designers. Maybe you've, you know, if you've attended playtest sessions, you might have met other people there and made contacts. I mean, have you actually, you know, you just said you've made contact with other designers and other people in the industry. I mean, how did that go? I mean, how did that come about? And how do you find maybe, you know, bouncing ideas off other designers? Is that what you do?
So I have quite a nice like pool of designers who contribute to the newsletter, and they're all lovely people and I get on really well with them. And then there's probably about three or four people that are designers, and they'll share their ideas with me and I'll share my ideas with them, and we know we're kind of keeping it secret because it's maybe like our next idea but we haven't announced it yet and stuff like that. And it's really, really nice just to have those people. Like, I know in this year alone, I've met people online that are going to be friends forever. And I might never, ever meet them because they're like in the States and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But they're going to be friends forever. But yeah, I guess when I say I'm not really in the board game industry, I mean, like all of the information about like publishers and distribution networks and all of those things. I've got no clue about any of that. But if it's self-published little games, I know tons of those people.
Good thing.
And they're my favorite people, by the way. So that's it's good to be around those people. And obviously reviewers and beautiful people like that as well.
Have you got any advice actually for somebody who wants to like turn their idea into a fully fledged game and maybe go the same route you did, like with Kickstarter and stuff? Was it a really big, like, you know, a really big effort to, well, of course it's a big effort, right? Because if it was easy, everyone would do it. But have you got any like tips or suggestions maybe that people might want to think about if they want to do what you did?
I had someone ask this specific question quite recently, and my go-to piece of advice would be, if you've got an idea for a game, make it. So if you get a prototype made up and then look at all of the work you need to do, getting quotes from manufacturers and getting a following together and everything else like that, it can be quite a lot of work. Yeah. But there are even indie publishers that are quite happy to just do most of that work for someone. So it's worth looking at. But I think if you at least make your game into a prototype, if you go no further than that, then you and your friends and your family have got a nice little game that you can play that's just yours.
Yes, yeah.
If you spent like 6 weeks doing loads of research and then it falls through and you decide, well, it's not happening then, then that would be bad. But if you just start with a prototype and you fall in love with that, and if you don't fall in love with it, like I say, it's just another game on the shelf and you and your friends and family can play it. So I think just having that solid thing that you've made is a really good start.
Yeah. So would you say, well, your advice obviously is just, you know, make a prototype, make that game sort of playable, even if it's just with your friends and family. But you then, I guess, took the next step of playtesting the game. And at what point, what you were saying that, you know, at some point your husband was saying, well, you know, make this your real-time job, your daytime job, so to speak. So how did you go from, okay, I've made this prototype, I tried to win and seems to be working and it seems to be a lot of fun, to then going, okay, I need to take this game out, get it play tested. You know, what happened after that initial thing? What did you take to the next step basically after that?
Yeah, okay. So basically, as soon as I thought, yeah, I could do this, I launched myself into research. I read all the blog articles and bits and pieces and recommended reading for Kickstarter. I started, as soon as I knew what my components were going to be, how many cards, my tokens, box size and stuff like that, I started sending out quote requests to manufacturers. I really wanted to manufacture in the UK, but there's just no way to do it and it be a job. Like, you could do it as a hobby.
Okay.
But you couldn't actually properly make money. I think the cheapest I got as a quote for like making 500 games in the UK was like £11 a game. And wow, since okay. selling £16 a game, that's the postage of getting it to somewhere, really. Yeah. So yeah, then I looked at Europe because I thought that's the next best. And then as soon as I looked at China, I couldn't not really go get manufactured in China. But so one thing I will stress is I am a massive organization nerd. I really enjoy having all of this information. I like putting it into spreadsheets. I like having 10 quotes and working out what's best based on this, that, or the other.
Yeah.
And for a lot of people, that's a lot of hard work.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's worth just stating that it is hard work. but it's worth doing if it's something you really love. I think it is worth doing.
Okay.
Yeah, I really love your ethos, actually, of, you know, on the one hand, you're going out and you're getting these quotes and you want to make your game real because there is a cost to making your game real. But you're also seem to be very focused on, I just want to make my game and spread joy to people and watch people enjoy it. So I just there's something really nice about that idea, especially your voice is just like, you know, just go and make it. And even if you only play it, it's worth having made it. And I think a lot of people lose sight of that when the minute you head towards Kickstarter and you're thinking about other people who might want to see your game and maybe shops and getting it made and stuff like that. I love that you stayed really grounded. And do you think that you're gonna, you know, that's kind of your ethos, I suppose, behind, you know, why you're making games in the first place, that you'll hopefully stay that route, or would you like to make it big someday? Just really long
that's
question.
Really, by the way, thank you. That's really, really nice to hear. Yeah, I think that the thing that is joyous for me is the fact that the first time someone like actually received Try to Win properly, like I was like, oh, I did handwritten notes to everyone. I was like, I hope you enjoy your game.
Yeah.
And I had like 3 people on the day that they were mostly arriving in the UK message me to say, we love it. Not just we enjoy it. We had a good time. People love it. And that stage just like, absolutely golden. Like, I can't imagine. Anyway, get all choked up. It's so nice. But in terms of make it big, I've said a few times I don't want a publisher. I like self-publishing. If one of my games were to go viral and everyone wants it, then I am quite happy for my full-time job being packaging up the game I made that people love that's going out. I've met and spoken to a lot of people who, like, they see their extra quantity after Kickstarter as something to get rid of, where I see it as my job. Like, I now have stock.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I will sell the stock. And I've met a lot of people as well who they specifically say that they don't want to be a salesperson. They don't want to be retail.
No.
So once they've made their games, they want those games to just go out in batches of 100 to distributors and they'll sort it all out. Whereas I think because I was already like a crafter and had like a little online shop for the stuff I make, the idea that I've made a thing and then I wrap it up all nicely for someone and I send it out and they get it, that's just awesome.
Yeah, you are a bit of a crafter as well, aren't you? I think so. You enjoy actually the process of not just designing and playtesting the game and all that and researching it, but actually getting the physical copy at the end that you know you put everything in the box, you package it up, you know, you put the address label on, and it's your little thing that you're sending out in the world. So, and I think that comes across in all your games, and not just your games. I mean, things like your board game survival kit.
Yeah,
I think again it is sort of all about you being the person who likes to craft things, to create those little toolkit things. And is that the sort of thing that basically is a blind? You want to make fun things for people that you've made by hand and send them out, I guess. Is that what Atkin Games stands for?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I want to be making and designing things that make people a little bit happier. Like, talking about the board game survival kit, like, that for me was just kind of, this would be a nice thing and it's novelty. And I didn't think very many people who play green, red, blue or yellow would back it at all. Mm-hmm. And blue and green are the second and third most popular.
Oh, okay.
And yellow, everyone who said they played yellow, to like who actually messaged me to say I play yellow, because it was always because it's the last one left. Yes. Everyone else wants to be red, blue or green. But there's way more yellow people than red people on the campaign. Just find that really interesting. I liked the idea. And I like the idea that like future versions could be like metallic versions and loads of cool ideas like that. I've had lots around that. But the conversations I've had recently about how it could help people who struggle to differentiate colours and that in a post-COVID world when we're all playing board games again but still want to minimise our risk, we turn up with a little tin full of components and dice that you don't need to share with anyone else. So the idea that something I've made that is essentially just for fun, the idea was essentially, oh, you don't have my colour, I have, ha 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 ha. That was the initial idea. And then the idea that going further with that, it could actually help people who've struggled with playing board games to play in a more comfortable way. That for me is really brilliant. Makes me really happy.
No, I mean, I love the idea of the board game survival kit, toolkit, or the survival kit. And as you said, you know, people saying about, oh, you know, if they can't distinguish colors, you know, looking at shapes and you know, making their thing custom. And as I say, it's just a simple idea that, you know, everyone seems to latch onto. I mean, the campaign has done brilliantly, I would say. I mean, it's funded very quickly. And is it still going? I can remember now. Is it? Are we nearly done with it?
17 days left.
Yeah, so day of recording. I don't know whether by the time you listen to this, it might have just finished. But, you know, it's an amazing campaign. And again, as I say, it just shows that Atkin Games isn't just about games specifically, but anything's related and just the fun things, and like, you know, the knitted dice bags you did and all that stuff, you know. It's just absolutely, you know, amazing.
How do you find the time for it all? You are always doing something. It just felt like you just finished with Try to Win and there was something else, and then you opened it and it was like, oh wait, there's more. I don't know how you do it. Have you got like a ton of things lined up in the works is what I want to know. What's coming next?
So the thing I should have, so once I decided that I was going to make games, I like within like a month filled up a notepad of ideas.
Okay.
And I've said a couple of times that I've probably got about 6 years worth of work planned out ahead of me. It's probably a lot more than that by now. but I like that. I like ideas just keep coming and it's nice. So like after Try to Win, I had it all planned. I was going to be really structured and have it all planned out. And I was like, right, what? In the downtime between Try to Win funding and actually receiving games from China, which is quite a big gulf of time,
mm-hmm.
I was like, what I will do, my plan was, we'll go through that notebook. The three most fleshed out ideas I'll prototype, we'll play them all and decide what seems to be the next best thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But what happened is I had the idea for Malum Hortus and I fell so in love with Malum Hortus that I couldn't do anything else.
Yeah, is that a passion project?
Are you allowed to tell us about it?
Well, yeah. So I think of Malum Hortus as like my flagship game because it will be my biggest game. It will be a massive Kickstarter budget. I'm already nervous about trying to fund it.
Wow.
I do think it's why I get a little bit anxious.
Okay.
So like we've Mini Memory Mischief got 231 backers, which is phenomenal. I'm really happy with it. But
that's amazing, yeah.
Malum Hortus will need at least 300 just to fund at the basic level. So there's still like a little niggling of me, like, you couldn't do it yet. You can't put that up yet. No. But Malum Hortus, for anyone who doesn't know, is all about you play nymphs who have been drawn into a beautiful garden during the day. The sights, the smells, everything's gorgeous. And then at night, the beautiful flowers turn evil. And they're basically sapping your energy, your magic. So you start the game in the middle of a game board with four routes out. The shortest route is the most dangerous. The longest route is the least dangerous, but obviously longer. So there's like, you got to weigh up your skills and stuff. All the nymphs have like powers and weaknesses to certain flowers that might be on the board. So you like strategize before you're even playing the game at where your character, your nymph, is going to be, which route it's going to take, because you're only allowed one per route.
Yeah.
And there's critters to save along the way. And there's lots of like little story cards. It's two phases per round, basically. And during the day, you're playing cards that are runestones in order to do certain things and move a distance. And so there's no like roll and move for the nymph. They're like each card they do, which is could be gaining magic or healing themselves or whatever they need to do for that turn, then comes with a movement. So there might be a thing that you want to do, but if you move that far, you'll land on a flower and get attacked.
Right.
So yeah. I really like it's a cooperative game and you're all trying to get out of the garden.
Okay.
So I really like things that make you all talk to each other and decide how you're going to do certain things.
Cool.
Okay.
And then at night, the flowers move, and that is a roll to move. So the flowers will always move towards you, and if they land on you, they attack.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's night cards that another little bit of story happens, and they might have all moved twice in the night or something else to make it slightly different during the next round.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
And I'm really enjoying it. I'm really loving it, but it is a really big game, and the artwork is intensive. So I don't have much. I've got about 10 pieces of art for it so far. And I just need about 50. So
you have posted some on Twitter, haven't you? And you know, the artwork is absolutely gorgeous. And yeah, it does feel like it's like a little passion project. And you said earlier you are a graphic designer by sort of trade, I suppose, traditionally. So how does that help with actually making your own games? Obviously, you think of people like Ryan Lockhart, who sort of designs, illustrates, publishes everything himself. Well, there's obviously other people as well. Are you doing the same sort of thing? I mean, do you find it's useful that you basically do everything from A to Z? Or do you maybe, can it sometimes hinder? Or, you know, what is it about it, doing the everything from start to end, the illustrations, design?
Especially with Malum Hortus, obviously it would go a lot quicker if I had a marketing team and an artist and some people who are going to take it out to play test while I'm doing the art or whatever else. But I really like that I've done all my bits for myself. And there's a little bit of pride behind that. But also, I don't have the most brilliant health history. And if I'm working on a project and I need to delay it for some reason because of me, I can't let people down.
Yeah, okay.
So I've had a lot of people ask to collaborate, and I really like that I set my own kind of deadlines and things like that, and I'm the only one I'm disappointing if I can't make it.
Mm-hmm.
So but I admit there's a little bit of pride behind that. I like that I've published 2 games now, and I did all the video work, I did all of the animation, I did all of the graphics, and I like being a little one woman team, but it means that each day I can just do what I feel like doing on that day. Like if I've got a headache in the day and I just want to draw some pretty pictures, I'll draw some pretty pictures rather than looking at the facts and figures. But I quite like having a mixture of things to do, because when one thing stumps you, you could go away and do something else for an hour and then come back to it and you've worked out how to do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I've always found that I like doing lots of little bits. And I my job before graphic design was as a multimedia specialist in my last job, which did like video editing and audio and everything. So I had a slight background in most things, and I'd done video game design as one of my modules at university as well. So I had a bit of game design in general already there.
All the foundations.
So you got all the background. Yeah, amazing.
We're all there. I have to say, I wonder, you know, because you can kind of arrange your day around you how you like, does that kind of affect the kind of work you can come up with? Like, is it easier to be able to make things when you feel like making them, or is it harder to, you know, kind of have to have done things on a deadline?
So I think it's good for me mentally, because if I don't feel very well one morning, I can say, well, I'll have a restful morning and I'll get X, Y, and Z done later. And I tend to have like a minimum that I want to do each day. And if I manage that, that's good. And if there's extra, that's better. But I definitely have the ability to be very mind over matter with my body and be like, no, you have to do this amount today.
No,
you do actually have to get up and sit at the computer and do this.
So you're quite sort of self-motivated and disciplined, I guess, which I guess is important anyway if you're self-publishing and you know have that drive, which is great.
So I'm a lot better at that mind over matter thing as well if I feel like I have a customer. So if I'm working for someone, there's a bit more joy behind it that kind of helps you lift your mood and lift how you're feeling and get it done.
No, definitely.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, it does make perfect sense. I just wonder if you're sort of, you know, doing everything from A to Z, where do you get your inspiration for games or, you know, things like that, you know, sort of board games of other toolkit from? Where does that come from? Where do you get your inspiration?
I really want to say I don't know, but I'm going to have to think about it and give you a proper answer, aren't I?
You don't have to.
If it just comes out of the blue, that's great. I mean, you know, I suppose that's why you're a good designer. Yeah.
I should definitely go on a long, wavy conversation about where my muse is.
Yeah.
I think honestly, it's different every time. So Try to Win was obviously like melded in my mind because that's what I was doing that weekend. Yeah. It was games and it was triathlons.
Yeah.
Mini Memory Mischief was my husband really wanted me to do a game called Peaky Pointers because we're both computer scientists. It was always going to be a game about memory stacks. But all he had was the name Peaky Pointers. He was like, it's going to be called Peaky Pointers. So I started developing that, and that turned into Mini Memory Mischief, so it went from Pocket Peaky Pointers, because there has to be alliteration or it doesn't work.
Yeah, of course.
To Mini Memory Mischief. And Peaky Pointers is going to be a future game, but the game that we ended up making didn't really use pointers in the memory stack at all. Mm. And I was like, well, I'm a computer scientist. I'd be annoyed if someone sent me a game called Peaky Pointers and there's no pointers. So we changed the name, and there are going to be 2 future Mini Memory Mischief Micro and Chip games. There will be 2 future minting games with Micro and Chip, one called Peaky Pointers and one called Random Access Memory.
Okay. You heard it here first.
Yeah. So at that point, that was completely different. So Darren said, it needs to be called this. And it will be a memory stack. And then from there, I kind of got an idea of what I wanted to do. There was a few things we tried. And it is good living with like your number one fan and cheerleader, because just every time we played it, I was like, oh, actually, it would be better if we have one. Like originally, it had like two dice and some other bits, and simplifying it and things like that. Just each time we played it, he was like, it gets better every time we play it.
Excellent.
It was really nice.
So, well, it's lovely to hear, I suppose, you know, all the positives when you get cheered on all the time. My husband's the same way as yours. Sometimes I always think it'd be nice to have a little bit of criticism. You know, just instead of telling me everything's great, tell me where there might be a problem, because then it becomes hard to believe what they say when they're always so positive.
So actually, I love our dynamic, because he will say when something's wrong, but he doesn't articulate why it's wrong.
Okay.
And he said it's because he doesn't know. He just says, like, doing this thing seems a little bit more difficult than it ought to or something like that. And that again is my little pride thing of I want to do everything myself. He's telling me there's a problem, but I get to find the solution to it. I do take criticism really well if it's constructive. I have, like I've said before, I have had people who are just like, don't like your game. What could I do to improve it? Just don't like it. But like constructive criticism, I feel like I do take it on quite well. And he will tell me something's wrong, and then I get to go find a way to fix it. I quite like that dynamic. But he is still very enthusiastic and infused about my game. So that is a nice balance. Rather than him just going, I hate it. I hate it. It's awful. I don't think I deal with that very well.
So talking about playtesting then, I mean, obviously, as I say, you get to your game to a certain stage where you think it's ready. Do you then, how do you go about playtesting? Do you have people you send games to? I mean, maybe other designers, or have you like a playtesting group you share with? Or can people maybe sign up to playtest your games? I don't know.
Well, here's the thing. Let's find out. my process so far has been, I play it with Darren until we feel like it's a solid enough game to bring someone else in. That's usually my friend Matthew, who's my gaming friend. So we have played Malum Hortus with him over Zoom multiple times. And that works quite well, because it's a cooperative game. So it doesn't matter if it's his hands face up or anything like that. We played Mini Memory Mischief by phone with him. And I just like that he's my best friend and he gets to be like the third person to ever play it. And he is also a software engineer, and he enjoys trying to break things like that. That makes him happy. If he could find a fault, he'd really enjoy it. So I know that when he says it's good, it is good. Or at least by his standards, it is good. And then I try and find other people to play with. And I always want that to be based on like volunteers, because I don't want to just be like shoving something in someone's face and going, do this. So like with Mini Memory Mischief, I asked on Twitter whether anyone would like to try out the print and play for it. And a few people did, and they liked it. There was some feedback that I couldn't.
I'm telling you, they did.
What?
Some people did. Hint, hint. I enjoyed playing it with my wife, so yeah.
But yeah, and then, so that was my first, because I didn't send out review copies with Try to Win. So Mini Memory Mischief was my first time sending out review copies. And I feel like it's nice to kind of have that experience with reviewers. And obviously I need to work out who's the best reviewers before Malum Hortus, because that's going to be a fortune to make up and send to people.
Oh, God. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So I think doing it isn't by design that I'm doing lots of little projects before it. But the fact that I am is really good, because I'm learning and I'm building up some people, a bit of a following for it, and I'm learning which reviewers are nice and kind. That's really what I want, is kind. So the thing I would really want though is for my games to go to reviewers who like that kind of game.
Exactly.
Rather than just they have the biggest audience.
So
I knew Oliver liked Minting games, so that obviously went down. So I think my games were always good. There's two reviewers that have reviewed Mini Memory Mischief, and I can't think of not giving them my games in future.
Mm-hmm.
So That's
my favorite. Okay. Yeah. So just a question, actually, because in a sense, you're not new to board games, but you're kind of new to the online board game scene. And do you think, actually, that people treat you differently because you're such a small publisher and you do it all yourself? I'm calling you a publisher, but really you are everything. Yeah. And I just think there's this perception that because you're small, maybe your game isn't particularly, you know, as robust as somebody else's. And I wondered, have you experienced any of that? It sounds like you put so much joy into your games. I would hate to think somebody thought like that, but I'm just curious, what kind of reception did you get?
I think I'm more likely to get people because I am a girl rather than because I am on my own.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, a lot of people just assume that I am a man or assume that I am a team. I get a lot of, hi, guys.
Okay.
So most people just assume I think when I talk to, so for instance, Murder on the Cards is someone that I follow on Instagram, and I speak to Samantha, and I don't know if she's the only one on her team.
Okay.
But because I am a solitary designer, there's a little bit of my brain that always thinks I'm talking to a solitary person on the other end, and I don't realise that I'm talking to a different person every time.
Yeah.
And actually, there's five of them behind that Twitter account. So there's a few I know, like BA Games is Duke of Baslandia and Sam Stockton, his brother, and I really like that they're a brother team that design things.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think I probably get more stigma as a woman than as a one-woman team.
But it's interesting to see that people see the brand Attican Games and see the cat and do sort of assume that actually there are several people behind it, because as I say, the games and other things you've made, it does feel at first glance that there must be several people behind it. But when you then start following you on Twitter and see, oh, I've just knitted another dice bag and I've just done this and done that, and it is definitely obviously you behind it all, it becomes very clear very quickly. I mean, I think that's wonderful. I mean, it's nice to have these, you know, self-publishers going out there and doing their own thing and doing it from A to Z and doing the shipping and everything, which is just astounding. As I said, you've got your mini warehouse. Well, you'd like to have your board game warehouse, which you don't quite have yet, but you probably have like a little storeroom, you know, that the office is basically just full of boxes. So it's great to see that, and I think that's wonderful. Now, given that you've now done, what is it, your third Kickstarter that's running at the moment, fourth coming up soon, hopefully.
Yeah.
Why did you go for Kickstarter specifically? Maybe that's an obvious question. And then what did you sort of learn after your very first campaign and, you know, took into the following ones? Are there sort of specific things? You said you were reading up on everything beforehand, but I'm sure there's some lessons you took out of, you know, running your own Kickstarter, you know, for yourself specifically, that you applied later. I don't know, but they're worth sharing with other people. How did it all go? And as I say, why Kickstarter?
Yeah, so I'll happily tackle why Kickstarter first, because I was umming and ahhing between Indiegogo and Kickstarter.
Yeah.
And there were lots of pros and cons to both. Like Indiegogo, you don't necessarily have to have, you meet your goal, therefore you are, or if you don't meet your goal, you're not funded, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But obviously, if you are setting your goal based on what you need to make that project live, then it shouldn't really be a toss-up between those two, because you need that much for the product to go ahead. But the thing that won it for me with Kickstarter is the built-in board game audience. There is a massive board game audience on Kickstarter. For me as well, like, so I was really paranoid as well that I wouldn't make the target. So it's probably not widely known, but when I decided on, so a few people said, why is your target so low for Try to Win? And it was because I had already decided what I was going to invest into it.
Right. Yeah. So okay.
It was partially this is the amount I'm willing to put into my new business.
Yeah.
And this is the amount I need to make up for it, because I didn't think I would fund based on the true goal. And I was happy to do that for my first. And because it's making 1,000 of a game, which I then have, you know, 700 to 800 in my office ready to go out to people.
Yeah, exactly.
And then, I really liked with the minting games, though, that I could make the goal based on 100 because I'm making them myself at home. And I really like the process of making them myself at home as well. But I would say the things learned between my first one was reviews. Need reviews. people expect reviews, and I didn't have any. But I because it was before COVID, this time last year, about three days a week, I had board game events lined up. So I went to HandCon.
Okay.
I contacted loads of local board gaming groups, and I went to their groups individually. I had people sat there, like, actually back me and show their phone to me and be like, I love it. Here, I've backed it, which was really nice. I think that's why I've built up a little bit of anxiety about my other campaigns, because it is just online.
Yeah.
There's no meeting people, getting them to play it, demoing it, having a bit of fun or anything like that. It's like everyone I get has to be based on me doing well enough on the internet.
Yep.
I know you're kind of, has it ever, have you noticed a really big difference between doing a Kickstarter pre and post COVID then?
For me, yeah. So because I was so full of energy with these different events that I was doing, and I was meeting new people, and it was really lovely, and I was getting really good feedback as well for making some last minute improvements to the game. And doing it just stuck at home, because I work from home anyway, and I've worked from home for years, but knowing that I can't just go out and do things, or, you know, someone says, like, I've had shops be like, oh, well, if you come and demo it to us, and I'm like, well, I can't come and demo it to you. And stuff like that. Yeah. So it is really, really different, especially as, like, so many people have told me that they make most of their money through the year from conventions, and I've never gone to a convention as a designer with a game to sell. I'm trying to see the silver lining that maybe by the time I go to UKGE as a first time designer there, I might actually have four or five games published.
So is UKGE sort of the next target then, hoping that whenever that happens again, that you'll be there and you're presenting your games, and hopefully next couple of games in the pipeline that you can show people and have a stand there yourself, or what's your thinking?
I definitely want to give it a go. So last year, my number one biggest fan husband, as we've discussed, was like, yeah, you should go to UKGE. Everyone will love your game and want your game. I really need to get him some pom-poms so he can be a proper cheerleader. But I was really anxious about it, and like, yeah, but it's spending X amount of money that I don't have to see if people actually want to, like, get my game. I feel a bit more confident about it if I've got three or four different games that, like, appeal to different people.
Yeah.
And now that I've been making, like, pretty much everything I craft now is board game related, I could probably bring my, like, dice bags and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Have, like, a proper big store rather than just, here's my little pen. But yeah, I was really anxious about that, and then it didn't happen anyway.
No.
I'd love to go to UKGE. I don't think I'll be going this year, because I don't think that the COVID situation will be as settled as people are thinking it will be.
No.
But also, they sent me their exhibitor's handbook, and their first... Yeah. They were planning for early June, and they were planning for it to not be social distance. They were planning for a normal event.
Yeah.
And that just felt a bit, as someone with poor health, it felt a bit unsafe.
Yeah.
And it felt like, as an exhibitor, no, especially as you have to, like, have put your deposit in by March, I felt like, as an exhibitor, it would probably be last in, first out anyway if they do have to do social distance.
Yeah.
Because there'd be a lot less stalls if it's social distance.
Yeah.
Or they'd go ahead because the government has laxed guidelines enough that they can go ahead, and then I wouldn't feel safe there. So we decided it's definitely not happening this year.
I don't think it will take place. As you say, we all hope that we'll be able to go to these events again, but realistically it's not going to happen. As I say, even just the timelines for organising it, for exhibitors to sign up, deposits and all that. You know, yes, the big names can afford to put a deposit down, but, you know, I think UKG specifically lives from a lot of the smaller exhibitors as well. And it's just not realistic. And then same on the attendees. I think, you know, some people who might be in the area anyway, they might pop around, but will people travel up there? I don't know. As I say, it's not going to happen, I don't think. Even though I'd wish we could do it absolutely safe and as well. Oh, it's wonderful. We could, you know, see each other again. And I'd love to meet you guys as well. You know, that would be just nice to, you know, see you in person as well. But I don't think it's going to happen, unfortunately. So
I think as well, if when I do go, I go as an exhibitor, it might be a bit easier on me because I've got such a long list of people I want to meet. It'd be so much easier if I just say, well, I'm on stall X.
Yes.
At some point, rather than me trying to chase around finding everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah. We'll come and see you. Exactly.
It will be the weird triathlon / computer science / Malum Hortus themed exhibitors. Oh, and craft. And,
I love it.
I haven't actually told anyone the theme of my next minting game. And I've been umming and ahhing whether the first time I tell anyone is on this podcast.
And what decision have you come up everything. With?
Yeah, tell us everything. Well, so I announced on the newsletter today that it's two minting games of a similar theme that are separate games, but if you put them together, you get a third game.
Ooh, I like
that's
that.
That's all I've said on there.
Okay,
intriguing.
Oh, let's put pressure on you for more information. That sounds really exciting.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll tell you.
Yes.
World exclusive here. Come on, everyone, drum roll.
We're like real journalists.
So, it is a cat-themed game and a dog-themed game.
Okay.
The cat is called Feline Felonies, and it's all about cats going around the neighbourhood stealing things from people and then bringing them home.
Right.
The dog one is called Canine Capers, and the dogs are sniffing around the neighbourhood.
Oh, of course.
Finding clues to solve crimes and such.
Yeah.
So I have my first initial drawing of my Cocker Spaniel in like a Sherlock Holmes hat.
Nice.
And then the idea is if you have both games, you put them together and the dogs are actually trying to stop the cat.
Oh, amazing. That does sound amazing.
That's such a brilliant idea. Yeah, I love that. Too.
Really inventive.
You can play them individually or you can play them together.
Yeah.
Amazing.
That is fantastic, actually. Great idea. I can't wait to see this develop. This is going to be very exciting stuff. I can't think of any other game that does something similar. Can you? I know. That's brilliant.
But yeah, I've already got like the next one afterwards planned as well, which is going to be Tortoises and Rabbits.
Tortoises and Rabbits, okay.
Yeah, cool. So it's going to be Tortoise Terrors, and they're just going to go around nipping people, because tortoises like doing that.
They
nip
do.
People. But then the bunny ones, Rabbit Remedies, and they go around putting little plasters on things.
Oh.
And like mending things that are broken.
I love
so
it.
Oliver signs up for together, that now.
Obviously, they're mending the things that they're talking.
Definitely,
that's so cool. That's fantastic.
But definitely the rabbit one. I love rabbits. So that's put my name down for that one. And the others as well, of course.
you like design such a variety of games. Is there any type you enjoy designing more than others, or are you just kind of going, I have an idea, I'm going to turn it into something?
Oh, see, this is again my nature of not being able to choose favorites and liking a mixture of things. So, like, the little games are really nice because over the course of, you can play like 10 games in however amount of, like, you could just sit there and go, oh, what if we try this? Oh, what if we try that? Whereas like with Malum Hortus, because it takes like 60 to 90 minutes to play one game, that's like a once a week thing maybe. So it takes a lot more time to kind of iterate it and improve it slowly. But I am really enjoying that process because it feels more solid.
Yeah.
Every time there's a small improvement to it, it makes the game so much better, but there's a bit of delayed gratification with it because we tend to playtest it, go, we should try this in the next one, and then that's a week later. So it's not just like with Mini Memory Mischief, it was like, oh, what if we only had one dice instantly? Let's play with one dice. Oh, that works better.
Yeah.
Because originally it was like you roll two dice and then you pick one action, one to use.
Yeah.
But then it seemed a bit wrong when you roll the same numbers and you don't want to use either, and it's actually you hurt yourself. And as much as people do like take that here and there, they don't like when they've done something to be detrimental for themselves. So it works on one dice, choosing whether to use it or not. And it meant I could use a buffer, and the computer scientist nerd in my head got really excited about that as well. So
another thematic.
It was literally like, it could be stored in the buffer. Oh my god, yay!
Spot on.
Oh, Fantastic.
No, I do like that you have a variety of games, and it's nice to hear that yeah, there is literally, you know, it doesn't matter. It can be a complex game, can be a simple game, can be a big game, small game. You know, Attican Games designs anything as long as it's fun, yeah. I suppose, is the thing.
Yeah, I was thinking today everything in life would be so much better if we just added about 10% fun to everything.
Yeah.
You're not wrong.
But dial it up 10
10% will do for now.
Much better.
Excellent.
Yeah, mm-hmm. of course.
Sometimes it's inappropriate, but just add a little bit of fun to something.
Always. Like your Kickstarter videos and all that, they're all, always a bit of a fun, mm-hmm. so it's always
yeah,
good.
Yeah, I really like enjoyed that. The latest one, to be honest, and as soon as I had ideas for it, I was like, it's going to be silly, and I'm not apologising to anyone. It's silly. No. fun.
Well, I mean, we could talk probably for much longer, but I think we come to the end of this podcast, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So it was a pleasure talking to you. And I think what people obviously want to know, and they've got an idea of what you're all about and mm-hmm. what you do and how, you know, how much love goes into all these games. And the upcoming games, you know, everyone, sign up for the newsletter and go to the website. So where can people actually reach you? Where's the newsletter? Where are you available online and where can people find out more?
Okay, so I'm Attican Games on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Etsy and Pinterest, because I'm everywhere, and also on my website www.attikingames.com, and that's where you'll find the newsletter as well if you're interested.
She's everywhere. I knew it.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
She's omnipresent. She's watching you while you listen to this podcast.
Oh,
bye now.
And of course we'll put all those links on the episode notes as well, so mm-hmm. if you go to tabletopinquisition.com, which is where you find us and all the links to Antoinette and myself, and as I say, all the links mentioned in this episode are there, so easy to reach out. So I think that is really it. I think we'll just say thank you very much, Nikita, for joining us. It was a real pleasure. I really enjoyed finding out about, you know, Attican Games and where it all started and where it's all going to in the future. You know, very exciting, all these games coming up.
And spreading the joy, lots and lots of joy. I feel uplifted just from talking to you. You're just so full of excitement and happiness for games. It's marvellous.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the episode. Tune in for another one.
And we'll see you again soon. Thank you. Yeah,
till next time. Take care.
Bye.